Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
With the second presidential debate coming up tomorrow, we begin today with New York Magazine political reporter John Heilman, also co-author of Game Change, the book about the 2008 presidential campaign. Hi, John. John's cover story in New York this week is about President Obama and the Clintons. Bill Clinton is on the trail for the Obama campaign, trying to help undo some of the damage from the first debate, as in this appearance in Las Vegas last week, where he questioned the premise of Mitt Romney's first debate performance.
I had a different reaction to that first debate than a lot of people did. I mean, I thought, wow. Here's old moderate Mitt. Where you been, boy? I miss you all these last 2 years. So just show up with a sunny face and say, I didn't say all that stuff I said the last 2 years. I don't have that tax plan I had for the last 2 years. You gonna believe me or your lying eyes here? Come on. What are you doing?
Bill Clinton for Obama in Las Vegas. Sounds like he was in the middle of a barn, the way he was putting on that affect. And John Heilman, here's the debate season in a tiny nutshell, according to me. Tell me how much you would put it differently.
Okay.
In debate number one, Romney continued his recent shift from very conservative rhetoric to more moderate on some selected issues.
Agree.
Obama and Jim Lehrer decided both not to call him on it for their own reasons.
I'm not so concerned about Jim Lehrer, but I'm more concerned about, I think, the president's failure there was pretty stark.
In debate number two, Biden tried to refocus the conversation on the, quote, malarkey that he accuses Romney of engaging in, and Ryan.
Yeah, and on the ideological contrast between the two parties and the two tickets.
Good. Now comes debate number three, and we'll see if Obama can make some of that malarkey label stick, or if Romney can keep warming himself up for the white working class independents.
I think that's pretty fair with the interjections that I made along the way, Brian. I think, you know, the challenge in this debate for President Obama is twofold. There's a big mega challenge, right? The country, and we were just talking before we came on air about I'm doing a lot of traveling right now. I'm out in swing states and non-swing states. You know, the effect of the first debate is almost like, it's like urban legend now. Barack Obama got eaten by an alligator that came out of the sewer, you know. I mean, and people are really invested in the story. So 67 million people watched that debate. I think the number will be higher tomorrow night because a lot of people in the country now, whether they like Obama or don't like Obama, the big question of can President Obama save himself? Can he repair the damage is out there. So people are focused on it. He and his team. You know, one of the things that Vice President Biden did in that debate was he attacked, you know, Ryan with a kitchen sink. And there was a reason he did that, both to reignite Democratic enthusiasm, but also they had a weekend of attacks on Ryan and exchanges with Ryan over key issues, Medicare, taxes, abortion, other things that they've been spending the weekend focus grouping and testing in the field to see which of those attacks actually have traction, which don't, and be able to cherry pick them for President Obama. He's going to want to obviously try to change his affect and seem like he actually cares about winning re-election. He's going to want to try to score some points against Romney. But it's very difficult in this format that we have where you have regular voters asking questions. And it's a lot easier to like the classic debate maneuver of pivoting out of a question that's directly addressed to you to an attack on your opponent,
right,
is a lot harder when it's an average voter asking the question.
Because it's a town hall format tomorrow.
Right.
I saw one of the networks, I don't even remember which one, since they all carry the debate, promoting Tuesday night and saying, one-on-one, Romney-Obama. And it's really not one-on-one in this format. But I'm glad you mentioned the media's investment in the narrative that's taken place, because I think much of that narrative lets Romney off the hook for some reason. People think it's a bigger story that Obama took a restrained approach to that debate than that Romney pulled a series of switcheroos this late in the campaign.
Well, let's be clear. I mean, I think President Obama didn't take a restrained approach. President Obama didn't show up for the first debate. And I think that is a big story. And it raises, you know, some pretty fundamental questions for a lot of Democrats.
Have you reported out the theory and, you know, come to believe it or not believe it, that it was a conscious strategy on the president's part. He didn't want to look too aggressive. He decided he was winning. He didn't want to make any headlines.
Yes, all those things are true. And the president did not take his debate prep seriously. He doesn't like debates. He doesn't. He didn't like them in 2008. He thinks they are phony, bogus. That he doesn't like the he thinks it's he believes that the kind of conversation he wants to have about policy is taken does not take place is not well served by the short soundbite this kind of contrived format.
And I'm surprised that the media consensus that seems to be growing around the idea that it is a good reflection of somebody's ability to be president. Jim Lehrer, Carol Simpson, all these people I've been talking to on the air who say, you know, when I ask exactly that question, that doesn't show somebody's ability to create jobs or run foreign policy with the Iranians. And they all answer the same way, but it shows the president's ability to get the people on his side.
Well, look, I mean, this goes to a big mega question, right? Does campaigning in general, does running a successful campaign, does giving a good speech, does any of those things, you could say, you know, is not actually a very good window into how someone will actually run the White House or run their administration. And this is a long-running debate about campaigns in general, withstanding the rigors, withstanding the scrutiny, going through all that stuff. So all of them are not perfect proxies. That's fair to say.
But we're still talking about Obama.
Yes, and yes. You want to come back to Romney.
That Romney should be half the story here.
I agree.
And so, like, CNN had a piece by the centrist commentator John Avalon. You probably know him, centrist independent with plenty of conservative cred. And he listed abortion and taxes and immigration as all of these things that Romney is suddenly tacking back toward the center on.
Yes.
And yet nobody's really asking the question, did Romney pull a fast one here? It's all about Obama looking dull.
Well, I think there are two different things that are true. Like, one is, it is, in fact, and again, I'm not putting off the question, the substance question. Let me get to that secondarily. But it is the case that any politician, whether it's this president or anybody else, if you want to make the argument that someone's pulling a fast one, it is incumbent on you as a strategic and just basic imperative to make that argument. The fact that the president failed to call Romney on those evasions or those switcheroos or whatever is a reasonable thing to criticize President Obama for. If you want to drive the media narrative that he's a fraud or a phony or he's etch-a-sketching, you got to make that argument.
Right.
President Obama didn't make that argument. Now, on the substance of it, I think the most extraordinary thing about this campaign in a lot of ways is that everyone, including the Obama team, assumed that Romney was going to do something like this. It's not remotely unprecedented. You know, the history of presidential politics, left and right, is that you end up running further to your extreme in the primaries to win the nomination, and then you gradually tack back towards the center. The Romney campaign said, you know, they used the etch-a-sketch metaphor. That's theirs. That's not ours.
Right.
That was their thing. But then they didn't do it. And so you had him still campaigning in a very base-driven way all through the late spring, summer, into the convention. And then even through September, you still have Romney going to rallies in North Carolina with evangelical leaders in the crowd, prominent evangelical leaders. That looks like, again, everyone started to interpret this as they've made the decision that they're not playing for the center, that this is all going to be a base election, all about turnout. And then he walks out of the debate stage.
That's the nomination of Ryan, by the way.
Exactly right. And he comes out on the debate stage, and all of a sudden, not in a gradual way is he making this shift back to the center, on one night, boom. Boom, 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 boom. And I think, you know, yes, I think it's incumbent on the media to point these things out. It's something that I've done on television and in things that I've written. I think we should call him out on those things. But strategy is successful, it really will. If Romney wins the presidency, it will rewrite the kind of canonical text of how you campaign. That maybe it makes more sense in our current, again, from a purely strategic point of view,
I understand.
It makes more sense to pull a last second switcheroo than to try to gradually waltz your way back from the further conservative or further liberal point of view over the course of many months. Maybe this is, in fact, the way you do it in this modern environment that we now live in.
And what about Ryan and Biden? Here's another example for me of, you know, the fact that for the media, who smiled and who frowned is a bigger story than the substance of what they said. Here is Martha Raddatz, the vice presidential debate moderator. Her big takeaway from that debate, as she articulated it on ABC This Week yesterday.
But one of the things I think Joe Biden did was in that little intimate table, very small, he was too big. He was like he was at a campaign event. So you could even you could feel that, especially at that table, that Joe Biden was so aggressive. So there were surprises there. I was surprised at Paul Ryan that he didn't jump in more, but that was clearly the strategy. But when you walk off, you're not quite sure how it went.
So a great foreign policy reporter who presses the candidates on Libya and Afghanistan and Iran, and she comes away saying the big story was that Biden's smile was too big for the table.
Well, you know, I'd like to hear that entire interview in context to know whether that's all that Martha was saying. But, you know, it is the case as since Kennedy-Nixon that the visual affect of these debates matters a lot, and it makes an impression on voters. And so to do some amount of analysis about how people about the affect of the candidates and their performance is not unfair. At the same time, you know, I found it really interesting with Ryan. You know, there was a little bit of him tacking to the center. He talked about bipartisanship in his debate performance in to a degree that you don't normally associate with Paul Ryan, not someone who you think of as a big bipartisan deal maker in the Congress. But what's interesting about Ryan is if you go back to the convention, I just want to like just make one put one good word in for our colleagues in the media. Remember Ryan's convention speech. What was the story of Ryan's convention speech? It was not he gave a great speech. He made a great performance on the stage.
He told a lot of lies.
It was that editorialists and news reporters across the country attacked him on the facts of that speech. And that was, I thought, quite extraordinary and quite heartening in some sense. Not because I want to attack Paul Ryan in a partisan way, but because you saw across the country, not just in the major national newspapers, but in swing state local newspapers, people were going after the substance of the speech, when it would have been very easy for them to focus on the notion that the bright national debut of this young coming rising star in the Republican Party. So, you know, I actually think he was more he did a lot less of that, the things that were questionable on the facts in the debate than he did in his convention speech. And it was noticeable, I think, that Ryan actually did a fair amount of trying to remedy what was a problem from the convention. And the truth is there were plenty of things that Joe Biden said in the debate that if you want to apply the same fact-checking model on Joe Biden, there were things he said about tax cuts. There were things he said about foreign policy. There were things he said about Libya that were open to substantive critique in the same way that you're suggesting we should be doing in general.
There are people who there are moments in the campaign that people are anxious to fact check and moments they're not. I tried to do a fact checking segment the morning after Bill Clinton's convention speech.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Nobody wanted to talk about it.
They
wanted to talk about what a master he was.
Although I'll say that speech it's very hard to go through that speech and find a lot that's factual. The president, one of the things that, and I know we're going to talk about this later, but you know, in the piece that I wrote about the Clintons, one of the things that he did that he was extraordinarily careful about was trying to get, I mean, his thing was, I want this thing to be bulletproof factually. Uh-huh. So he had done a lot of research so that there was nobody who was going to be able to pick him apart on the facts.
John Heilman from New York Magazine and author of the book Game Change with me. And listeners, I want to get you going on the phones for something that we're going to do right after we finish up with John. We thought we might do a little pre-debate role play today. No doubt if you are an Obama or Romney supporter, when you were watching the first debate, you were sitting on your couch going, no, don't say that. Here's what you should be saying. Well, this is your chance. Call in at 212-433-WNYC. If you want to role play, not impersonate, but kind of role play, you'd be a surrogate for Obama or Romney. You know, think of it as being the Reince Priebus or the David Axelrod or the Stephanie Cutter or the Ed Gillespie. If you watch the Sunday shows, you know those Democratic and Republican operatives go on all the time as surrogates for the candidates. If you think you could do a good job as a Barack Obama or a Mitt Romney surrogate, call us up right now and get in line at 212-433-WNYC. And when we're finished with John Heilman, we'll do a short little role play with some of you as if it was tomorrow's debate. We'll have rules. We'll give you 60 seconds to answer some questions, et cetera. So if you want to be Romney or be for Romney or be Obama or be one of his surrogates, call in and we'll get a couple of you ready to go, all right, in a few minutes. Because why should the candidates have all the fun? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. All right, John, your cover story in New York Magazine this week is called Bill and Hillary Forever, and it's about the legacy and influence of the Clintons on the 2012 election. Now, let's flash back with a little piece of tape to set this up of Obama in January 2008 talking to a newspaper in Nevada about past presidents and mentioning Bill Clinton in a less than flattering way.
I don't want to present myself as some sort of singular figure. I think part of what's different is, are the times. I do think that, for example, the 1980 election was different. I mean, I think Ronald Reagan changed the trajectory of America in a way that, you know, Richard Nixon did not, and in a way that Bill Clinton did not.
Well, that's a tough starting point from which to build a long political marriage.
Yeah. You know, look, it's funny that, you know, Obama was very much trying to get in Bill Clinton's head by saying that. And it was a tactic that he used. Bill Clinton in 2008 did not see it as a tactic. He actually took it personally. And there were a lot of things that made Clinton lose his mind in the late winter and early spring of 2008. That was one of them. But, you know, it's interesting because it's embedded in this deeper thing. Obama did run in the Democratic primaries in 2008 as an antidote to Clintonism. He said, you know, Hillary Clinton was, you know, a poll-tested, calculating kind of politician, was not a politician of conviction, that they play small ball. And it was that critique of and there was a lot that he'd written in The Audacity of Hope about how the partisan warfare of the 90s was a product of baby boomer psychodrama between Gingrich and Clinton. So now, flash forward, Obama is supposed to be the antidote to Clintonism, a new kind of politics, postpartisan and visionary, right? Now it's 4 years later, he's running for president, and Bill Clinton is his greatest, most important ally on the campaign trail, and Obama is explicitly running not as an antidote to Clintonism, but as an inheritor of Clintonism. He talks constantly about how he wants to go back to the policies that made the 90s so successful, about the kind of paradigm that Bill Clinton ushered in. He is very much now the inheritor of the creed, and I'll tell you, the person who loves that more than anybody else on earth is Bill Clinton.
Yeah, no kidding. And here's an example of that for our listeners, because people around here don't hear these ads that are running nonstop in the swing states. So here's a little Obama campaign commercial example.
President Obama has a plan to rebuild America from the ground up, investing in innovation, education, and job training. It only works if there is a strong middle class. That's what happened when I was president. We need to keep going with his plan.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
So after all this getting in his head from 2008, and I realize he appointed Hillary Secretary of State,
right.
Why does Bill Clinton want this role?
Well, that was the start. I mean, obviously, Hillary Clinton being appointed Secretary of State was the beginning of the détente, so to speak.
And she's leaving. She's announced. She's not hanging around for the second term.
She's not. Although that's pretty conventional. Secretaries of State. She's had 4 years, so that's a pretty normal thing to do. It's not. She's not.
Right.
She's doing a full term.
But
and
just
then,
to say that Bill doesn't have that built-in investment for the re-election.
Well, that's true. Let me go back to one thing that I said a second ago, which is, you know, his investment in this campaign, is. He's seeing Clintonism restored to its rightful status, and he likes that a lot. He believes he had an important presidency and was very successful. There's obviously a psychological satisfaction of seeing Obama validate and resurrect Clintonism. The other thing is he believes on policy. You know, whatever his personal – there's still not a lot of warmth between Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. This is a transactional relationship, but he thinks Obama's better on policy than Mitt Romney. He thinks Romney is just Reaganism or is it just Bushism redux. He doesn't think that's the right course for the country. And in the end, what matters most to President Clinton is policy in a lot of ways. Thirdly, you know, I think he is thinking about 2016, and he's told everyone around him that he wants Hillary to run in 2016. Publicly, of course, she's saying, I'm not even thinking about this. He has publicly said, I hope she does, but he really wants her to run. And I think he believes that one way or the other, whether Obama wins or Obama loses, the kind of restoration of Clintonism, as I said a second ago, to its rightful status is good for her.
So that gets built regardless of the outcome. Do you think that they believe that it's better for Hillary's chances in 2016 if she runs, if she's following an Obama second term?
Unquestionably. Unquestionably.
Better than if she's challenging Romney?
Unquestionably. There's no situation. Let's say two things that are historically true. One is it's hard for any given party to win three consecutive terms in the White House. So that's the case against her. Again, why it would be better for her for Romney to be president. The other thing is if you believe the economy is going to stink for the next 4 years, challenging Romney – well, having a break from Democrats, challenging Romney in a bad economy, that's a fortuitous, you know, possibly a salutary set of circumstances for her. The other side of the coin is if you believe what I think they believe, which is First of all, Bill Clinton convinced that the economy is about to rebound in a significant way, number one. And number two, you'd always rather be contesting an open seat
right.
than contesting a sitting president, because the powers of incumbency are great. And so whatever you want to say about Mitt Romney, especially if you believe, as Clinton does, the economy is going to rebound no matter who the president is, Romney with a strong economy, you'd much rather have the open seat coming out of Obama than have to challenge Romney 4 years down the road.
You don't go there in your piece, but I wonder if you've thought about Bill Clinton's role or lack of role in the 2000 election. Al Gore famously kept Clinton on the sidelines, and I think at least some Democrats look back on that and wonder what would have been if Bill Clinton had been allowed to forcefully campaign on behalf of his VP.
It was one of the most horrible strategic miscalculations of the Gore campaign at the time. You know, President Clinton was enormously popular in 2000. He had suffered some from the Monica Lewinsky scandal in 1998. He then suffered after he left because of the Mark Rich pardons and other things that happened. But in 2000, he was extraordinarily popular. And the bottom line was that for most voters, Gore was running away from a record that he could never run away from. He'd been Bill Clinton's vice president for 8 years. And so to distance yourself was like an exercise in futility. They were still worried about the overhang from Monica too much, when what he needed to do was wrap his arms around Bill Clinton's the economic record that Bill Clinton and he had built together. There's no better spokesman for that record than Bill Clinton himself. In that moment, there was no better spokesman. He was a better spokesman for that record than Al Gore was or ever will be. And to push Bill Clinton into the shadows was just a disastrous, disastrous decision by Gore.
We're almost out of time, but you describe the absolutely bizarre moment in December 2010 when Obama, coming off of midterm defeats for the Democratic Party, had negotiated an extension of the Bush tax cuts with Republicans in Congress. Bill Clinton visited him to discuss policy, and they decide to hold an impromptu joint press conference. So it's Clinton and Obama side by side in front of the press.
Yes.
But then Obama leaves and goes to a holiday party and leaves Clinton, who stays there for another half hour, fielding questions by himself. Was that intentional?
It was a surreal moment. There's no question. I think they cooked this up on the fly. They had a meeting. It was the first long meeting they'd had in the first two years of Obama's term. And they had this great meeting. And Obama at that moment was facing a liberal revolt from congressional Democrats who were unhappy with this tax cut compromise. And Bill Clinton was as frustrated as Obama with the left at that moment. And Clinton basically said, I'll go out there and I'll do this. Let me go out there and take some questions for you. Let me help you. They went down there, and Obama clearly said, I'm going to go back to this Christmas party and let Clinton take some questions. I don't think Obama ever thought Clinton would take a half an hour of questions. And there was a moment, if you look at the video, it's fantastic, because you look up there and you go, wow, like Bill Clinton's behind the White House press briefing room podium. Like, you kind of forgot for a second who the president was. He was having the time of his life. And I'll tell you, the more important thing that he was having the time of his life, it worked. He helped Obama to quell that liberal rebellion. There's no one with more credibility among congressional Democrats than Bill Clinton still. And they all kind of looked and said, you know, Bill Clinton's endorsing this deal. Well, I don't like it, but I'm going to have to swallow it.
Yeah. From our comments page, John, somebody writes, an interesting John Heilman headline indicator. From game change to Bill and Hillary Clinton forever. What a world. So can we read something into that shift in the names of your pieces?
You know, look, I mean, these I don't give the pieces in the magazine their headlines, and but I'm perfectly happy with that one. I just think, you know,
and Hillary was in the subtitle of your book, right?
Yeah, she was, of course. And the Clintons are huge characters in the book. But it is one of the great the Clintons are one of the great political stories, one of the great psychodramas of our time. And the way in which the way in which they went from so bitter, so unhappy, so feeling as though they had something taken from them, usurped by this usurper, Barack Obama, how they, in stages, Obama brings her in as Secretary of State and then gradually works his way to, as I say, this transactional but highly functional kind of working relationship with Bill Clinton right now. You played that ad before, Brian. That ad with Bill Clinton, direct to camera, vouching for Obama's economic record, has played more than 16,000 times in the swing states. It is the ad that the Obama campaign has run more than any other ad. Maybe the 47% ad has gotten close. the ad that just had Romney's, just the video of Romney talking about the 47%. But that ad has been what they've leaned on. And there's another ad with Clinton and Obama in which you see Clinton's convention speech and Obama's convention speech back to back. It looks like they're running mates. The Obama campaign knows that Bill Clinton has economic credibility with swing voters unlike anybody else in the country, and they are leaning on him really, really hard.
Give me one more thing on tomorrow night.
Yeah.
Romney has done a lot of town hall style meetings
yes.
in these last 2 years. Obama hasn't done them, at least recently. Who do you think that format actually favors? And is it disadvantageous for Romney because it's in the company of regular people that he most risks looking like an out-of-touch rich guy?
Well, look, Romney has a fundamental – that still has a challenge. One of the things in the polling that's come out just today, the Washington Post ABC poll that came out, you see that his favorability ratings have finally started to rise. He was a terminally unfavorable – his unfavorable ratings have been out of whack in a historical context for a long time. They're starting to move now. The debate seems to have actually moved that. He is now considered more likable than he was just 2 weeks ago. But he still is not seen as empathic with struggling middle class and working class voters to the extent that he needs to be. So this is a huge opportunity and also a huge risk for him. If he knocks it out of the park with these real voters tomorrow night, he could do himself a world of good. If he does what he has done many times in the past when interacting with real people and fails in that regard, it could be devastating for him. So he's got – it's a high-risk, high-reward thing for him. President Obama is going to have to confront someone tomorrow night, I guarantee it, who says, I voted for you in 2008. I loved you. I invested a lot in you. I am really disappointed, and you need to explain to me how it's going to be different these next 4 years. And he's been asked that question a couple times before, and it's kind of flummoxed him in the past. It's going to be a big moment in this debate when someone asks him that question tomorrow night to see how he reacts.
John Heilman, co-author of Game Change, New York Magazine, political correspondent. He has the cover story this week. The article titled, not by him. That's what reporters always say. I don't write the headlines. It's some headline writer in the back office somewhere who writes this headline.
Some
sensational-oriented eyeball grabber who writes headlines like Bill and Hillary Forever in New York Magazine this week. John Heilman, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Don't forget, everybody, that tomorrow night we will have coverage once again of that debate live here on the station. And once again, I'll be hosting a pre-debate call-in for some of you and listeners to swing state public radio stations who are coming together in a pre-debate call-in network that begins tomorrow night at 8 here on WNYC. And when we come back in just a minute, we'll put some of you who've been waiting on hold on the air for a little Obama-Romney debate role play. Stay with us.